This is the Daily Brief Podcast. Today, at the start of the new year, I have with me the beautiful and talented Linda Ong. She is former CEO and founder of Truth Co., which is an omnicultural branding and insights firm. She is now Chief Culture Officer for Civic Entertainment Group. Prior to that, she was Senior Vice President of Marketing for Oxygen. We're going to talk about all that. And we are also going to talk mostly about the cultural trends that Linda thinks will shape entertainment in 2018. And Linda is a culture savant, so I'm excited to hear what she has to say. So hello, Linda. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Paige. Thank you and Happy New Year. And thank you for the great intro.
You're welcome. I hope this is the first of many regular appearances by Linda. I'm just putting that out there right up front. All right. So before we get into the sort of the meat of the conversation about cultural trends, I just want to get everybody up to speed on your background and also why is it that we're talking to you about culture? So you have a long background in marketing. You served as SVP of marketing for Oxygen, as I mentioned. Then you went on to found Truth Co. So can you just walk us through what Truth Co. was, what you founded it to do, and how you applied what you learned from Oxygen and your prior jobs to that company?
Yeah, great. Well, when I started Truth Co., I actually had just left Oxygen as head of marketing, as you mentioned, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I just, after the sort of the sprint to launch, I just needed to clear my head and shake the cobwebs out a little. But what I found was that I was really passionate about developing brand strategy from a creative point of view, because I found that there are a lot of really great strategies out there, but they were very smart and logical, but they didn't inspire creatives. So I really kind of started from the point of view that strategy and creative needed to be more connected and that we needed to mind the gap there. And along the way, I had the good fortune to work with the team at Bravo, which was at the time Lauren Zelaznik, Jason Klarman, and Jane Olsen, just at the time when NBCU had acquired them from Rainbow. And we had the task, which was really formidable at the time, of relaunching the network, which at the time had been a very sort of polite arts and culture network. And the ambitions that NBCU had was to make it much more mainstream. So we all know what happened with Bravo after 2004. We all watched what happened, right? And Bravo became a pop culture powerhouse. And like I said, I was really proud to be part of that team. It was a true collaboration. But what really happened to me personally and professionally was I got a giant hard-on that everybody was talking about the brand that I had worked so hard with this team to develop, and that it became a part of the culture. And so for me, I started investigating, how do I do that every time? Because it really was so exciting and so inspiring every time to have people talking about this brand in a way that was affecting their lives, not just their television viewing habits. So what happened a couple years later was I met some people that helped me understand that you could really turn this observation of culture into a discipline, and that it could be analyzed, and it could be, in a way, sort of looked at from a more academic standpoint rather than just gut and intuition, which is what a lot of people have. A lot of really successful television programmers and marketers just have a really good feel, and they can leverage that into great programming and marketing. But I also felt that those kinds of sensibilities that I also was really conscious of in my own life could really be looked at in a more rigorous way. So we developed a cultural insights practice at Truth Co. In 2008, so about 10 years ago, which was really fascinating because it was at a time before social media, before digital content, and the opportunity to really dive into not only what was going on, but really understand why things were changing in terms of perceptions and tastes. And this was 2008, right around the time of the economic collapse, the rise to the fore of millennials, the great population change in demographics from the growth of Hispanic population, as well as the economic collapse and social and digital culture. All these things became this amazing, perfect storm that changed the last 10 years, and we're still really, really, really feeling it now. So had the opportunity last year to do everything we'd been doing in brand strategy and cultural analysis and take it to the next level beyond the television and media business, and that's why I joined Civic.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of follow-ups off of that. So Bravo, sure. Did you work on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy on that launch?
No, that was before NBCU's acquisition.
Oh, okay. All right. And then it's interesting also that you talked about connecting strategy with creative and how it's something that I have never thought about being disconnected, but just mentioning that, I think I can see where that would be really frustrating for creatives to be given a strategy and be like, okay, implement this creatively and not really have any connection yourself to what that strategy is. I think that's it.
Yeah. Well, I think also because a lot of strategy, especially in the network space at the time, was being very research driven, which is not to say that it's wrong, but it's that's a very logical process. And we know from sociological studies that consumers make their decisions about brands based on, you know, the majority of it's based on emotion, and then they use logic to post-rationalize the decision. And that's true whether you're buying a car or a phone or watching a television show, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's like, I want to watch that show, and then you can tell all, oh, it's got great writing and great performances and blah, 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 blah. But sometimes it's just an emotion that you can't really define. And I felt like a lot of strategies that I was reading, and I started in this business as a creative. I started as an art director and a writer-producer. So for me, if my creative, you know, my creative fires weren't burning from a strategy, I could understand that it would be difficult. And then you have, and you know, this still happens, but at a time it was more common than not, is that the creatives would have to just kind of either go do their own thing or, you know, go rogue, or that the strategy and the creative just, you know, what the creative ended up being, again, more logical than actually inspiring people to want to watch. So to me, it was a really ripe area. But what happened, I think, for me after that was that I was seeing stuff that was going on in the culture and feeling really intensely that sometimes I felt other people weren't seeing or clients weren't seeing because they were just emergent. They weren't really in the mainstream yet. And I feel like everyone says they want to be ahead of the curve, but unless they can see it, they don't want to do it. And when you're talking about ideas that are emergent and ahead of the curve, often they're harder to see. Mm-hmm. So I just needed a way to present that to clients where they had the confidence to understand that these were real ideas and concepts that were bubbling up and conversations that were bubbling up in culture. And again, a lot of this was before there was social media, so you couldn't really see it. Now it's a lot easier to see. But in a way, it's become more confusing for people because it's everywhere, right? And everything seems equal volume. So I think in some ways, this kind of practice has become more necessary than ever before. And in fact, 10 years ago, when I was talking to people about culture, they literally said, what is that? Is that yogurt? And why do I need it, right? Mm-hmm. And I even had someone say to me, well, I don't believe in culture. It's just all luck and timing. Well, timing is culture. So, you know, I in the early days, I felt a little bit like Chicken Little, like saying, hey, look, this change is happening. It's happening, and people didn't want to believe me. And now it's really great because now we have 10 years of experience studying all the changes. We have 10 years of a track record and published proof that we were able to anticipate big swings in culture before they were widely recognized.
So that's that question that people asked you is sort of my question too. So when you're at TruthCo and you're saying, I'm going to present to you emergent culture and how you can brand around that, did you rely on research for that? Or was it sort of emotion or a combo? Did you have a process that you offered?
Yes, we. I hired a team of analysts, and we developed and are still evolving at Civic, even our methodology. But it, you know, really, what we our fundamental conceit is that we don't talk to consumers; we analyze the things that speak to them. So we know that the conversations that are going on in culture, whether it's in film, TV, books, magazines, social media, internet, art, fashion, music, retail, physical spaces, architecture, all these things that people are, you know, man-made ways of expressing ideas and emotions are out there in the world, and they can be analyzed and they can be looked at in a form of cultural anthropology, right? We can say, what is the culture expressing about itself right now? And really by looking at the ecosystem of ideas and the trajectory of how some ideas start gaining ground and momentum and then become really strong and other ones fade from culture. You know, it's really about understanding, and now actually because of digital culture, these things change faster than ever. As we know, like a year ago, it was a completely different conversation about women and sexual assault, and, you know, we weren't even talking about that a year ago.
There was no conversation. Yeah.
Right. There was no conversation, at least not an explicit one. And so, you know, for any network right now, you know, who is dealing with any kind of viewer, whether you're a female specific or not, they have to be asking themselves, how does this change the way our content and our brand are being viewed? Because it does.
Content okay, so wait. So I'm wanting to get into that now that you said that. I just want to talk a little bit about Civic before we dive in.
Okay,
so
sure.
Just explain to everybody what Civic Entertainment Group is, what it does, and what you do there as Chief Culture Officer.
Great. Well, Civic Entertainment Group is a non-traditional marketing agency. And in fact, we have a lot of debates about whether we even want to be an agency, really a company. At its core, we are an experiential marketing team with a mission, which is we're called Civic because the two founders, Stuart Rutherford and David Cohn, came out of city government. They used to work in the Giuliani administration in New York, and they were the pioneers of public and private partnerships. They were the ones who actually saw you could help cities become more livable and be more prosperous by bringing brands into the conversation. And so what we're really doing now is really helping brands become better citizens, helping them understand that they need to participate in society. And that could be in large and small ways. That could be very overt, like coming up with a pro-social campaign, which a lot of our clients do. Or it could just be about understanding what's going on in society and how your brand and your brand values can help better that and how you can message that and get credit for it with your consumers.
I think go ahead, sorry.
Oh, and you wanted to ask about my role. So
yes.
My role as Chief Culture Officer is essentially what I was doing at Truthco in terms of brand strategy and cultural analysis, which I've sort of synthesized. And Rajiv Menon, who came from Truthco with me, who's my rock star director of cultural strategy, is really about creating this hybrid of brand strategy and cultural insights. Because today I believe that you can't responsibly launch a network or launch a brand without really understanding where it lives in culture. There was a time when you could do those separately, but now it's too risky to launch a show or a brand without really understanding what's going on, what are the conversations that are going to impact you either positively or negatively. I kind of use the analogy of any time you're launching a new show or a brand, it's like launching a rocket ship. Right, and the network is NASA, and they're programming and, you know, doing all the calibrations and designing the rocket and training the astronauts and, you know, drawing the trajectory, et cetera. But what we do in cultural insights and cultural strategy is really monitor what's the atmosphere in which your rocket is going to launch, because if you're not checking out what, you know, the barometric pressure is or the prevailing winds, and recalibrating to make sure you're landing where you want to, you could go way off course and crash. And so I look at cultural insights as really de-risking your investment.
Okay, in my mind's eye, I just see like a bunch of detritus of crashed rockets.
Well, it happens because I think people often forget that, you know, consumers are dynamic and that what they liked last year and what they talked about last year is not necessarily going to be the same as what they are going to like this year. And I think that you have to stay with the consumer and with the culture. And sometimes people will say, well, we're not ready for culture yet because we're in development on the show. We're working a lot with programmers now. But actually, now what's happening, and that's what they used to say, they weren't ready. And now people can't get into culture soon enough. Like we're working with people before they even commission pilots. We're looking at scripts, we're looking at show Bibles, and we're helping them fine-tune, you know, what's culturally relevant about this now, what are the things you need to be on the lookout for, what are things that are changing that could either work for or against you. And then over the course of the development of a show, which could be, you know, 9 months to a year, and then the marketing, we have the ability to sort of ride the changes. It's sort of like catching a wave and riding it and knowing, you know, like as something happens in the news, how will this impact the way the show is being seen? And it doesn't necessarily, you know, it's not about knee-jerking, but it's about really anticipating how people will receive the information. And also, depending on your brand, you know, whether you want to be seen as very cutting edge, or you want to be seen as more traditional, or you want to be seen as right on the zeitgeist, those are all things that can be studied.
It's interesting because two shows, one show I just watched and one show I watched last year, which a lot of people watched. So the first one is Black Mirror. And then mm-hmm. the second one is, which maybe you will be talking about. And the other one is Handmaid's Tale. And it's just mm-hmm. interesting with both those shows because, well, Handmaid's Tale, I don't think it was intentional, but they really did ride that cultural wave. And I mean, to some extent, they couldn't have known how well they were going to time it because
right.
the development of that show happened prior right. to anybody knowing right that Trump was going to win. So that was sort of a lucky break, sort of. I do still think that, you know, you can sort of see the wins and think this is a project to do right now. And then Black Mirror, I think, is just a show that is designed to be in the cultural zeitgeist. So that one works out well.
I'm obsessed with Black Mirror. I will say we worked. The Civic worked on Handmaid's Tale on the launch. We didn't provide insights for them. But what I did hear anecdotally was that they assumed when they were in development on that show that Hillary was going to win.
Yeah.
So it seemed like it was going to be a dystopian fairy tale. And what it became after Trump won for a lot of people, or for the people who were supporters of that show and Margaret Atwood fans, it became a dystopian nightmare.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, context is everything, right? How you read something depends on what you're living. And that's, you know, everyone says, oh, we want to be relevant. We want to be culturally relevant. I can't tell you how many brands tell me that. But, you know, the ones that we work with understand that you have to study what that means. You can't just say, yeah, we want to be relevant. You have to study what relevant to who, relevant to what, right?
Right.
And those are all subjective, and we'll talk about this in a second because, you know, there are many different types of audiences. So I think that the idea, there's not one way to be relevant, I guess, is what I'm saying. And so, you know, really studying that from the perspective of your audience is important.
The other thing I think is interesting about that is if you look at what's happening with broadcast networks and cable networks to some extent, I think, you know, that they've made their living by having this broad reach and reaching a wide audience. Mm-hmm. And when you're operating like that, and not to mention the pilot, you know, the development and pilot schedule, it's hard to ride any kind of cultural wave because you're moving fast. You have a lot of different shows. You aren't niche. You aren't targeting in that way. So it's interesting just to think about, you know, this theory of using culture toward branding and development versus what the traditional business models have been.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think that all of this is in flux, as you know, especially with the OTT platforms really threatening broadcast business as well. But I do think, you know, everything, I believe I'm going to be, you know, pretty stubborn and say that I believe there's a cultural solution or a cultural perspective for every brand, for every business. And even in the case of broadcast, I would say that broadcast is increasingly becoming a family platform because there are very few things that families want to do together these days, or because of sort of the personalization of content. Mm-hmm. And so finding, you know, whether it's a live event like the Super Bowl or the Oscars or a show that, you know, like American Idol that the family can just watch together and it's just time to spend together, those things are becoming increasingly more important, and the reason is completely cultural. So
yeah.
I think that, you know, there's a place for that because, you know, it's not like you're going to sit down with all the kids and watch Black Mirror, right?
Right.
Another show I'm completely obsessed with for different reasons. But I think that, you know, there's an interesting reaction in terms of what's going on in media that's has a very symbiotic relationship with what's going on in culture. And, you know, the two influence each other, right? You can't have media without culture and vice versa.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I'm bullish. Is that right? Yes. I am bullish on the TV business in general. I do think one thing that keeps coming up for me is this whole Fox being sold to Disney and what that's going to mean for the Fox broadcast network. And, you know, they just at TCA today, I guess Gary and Dana talked about how 80% of Fox will be live in sports. So,
yeah.
That I mean,
exactly.
The fact that the Murdochs sort of are like, we're looking at the tea leaves and this is what we're going to do, which I think is the first break in that, where you've seen a huge business decision made based on, we think the future is going this way and we don't really know if we're in.
Right.
I mean, I think Rupert has a bigger strategy than that, but just watching that move, that's pretty ground shaking.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the right move, is because, you know, it's very difficult for people to compete on a content basis if they have very different business models, because all content is not created equal, right? If you want to compete for the premium audience right now, it's very difficult to do that on a broadcast platform. You just can't. And so they're just going to go for, I think they're doing the right move in that they're looking for platform specificity. What is the best use of this platform? And for right now, the best use of broadcast is live in sports, and sports being mostly live, right? So you're just basically saying live, right? And that's what will get people, that's what will get butts in seats in front of a monitor. Right.
Well,
it's not going to be content they can time shift. Is that's
right.
Just there. And why would I? Because I can watch it on my phone on a train. Right.
Right.
So I think that's the right move for them.
And Fox has invested a lot of money in sports. Right. So
exactly.
It also makes sense to lean into that. It's also that part's sort of interesting, too, because that's where Fox started, which was with the NFL and the NLB.
And their audience is more, you know, their available audience is more of a broadcast audience. So they're playing to what their platform and their audience want and not trying to fight that. And, you know, I can't say if they'll be successful or not, but I think that's the right move, is don't try to compete with Netflix.
Mm-hmm. All right. I've put this off long enough, so let's get into it. So what is the first trend that you see shaping entertainment in 2018?
Well, I think one of the things that is undeniably a force to be reckoned with from the last year is this emergence of all these voices and what we call unsung heroes, people that are now in the fore that were either marginalized or were not even seen by society, because we were so, for the past era, so fixated on big names, big stars, some people that everybody could recognize, everyone could point to. And now, for a lot of reasons that I won't go into, because that could be a whole nother podcast, we're much more interested in discovering either faces that we've never heard of, like a Yara Shahidi, who, you know, with Grown-ish is now apparently was top trending show last night on Freeform, to Rose McGowan.
Shout out to our friend Trisha Melton.
Yes, shout out to Freeform and Trisha Melton. You know, to Rose McGowan, who's the leader of the Rose Army and the resistance and the force behind the Harvey Weinstein toppling. You know, and she's someone who people had heard of and knew and maybe watched on Charm, but she was not at the forefront of culture. So these kinds of people, even Tarana Burke, who was the founder of the Me Too movement, was not a household name. And in fact, people, you know, it was very controversial when Time Magazine did their cover of the Silence Breakers. They didn't include her, and there was an outrage. That outrage is new, right? That outrage is you're not including people that nobody's ever heard of, but are important, right? So this idea about sort of the notion of not just celebrity, but heroes and who we celebrate and who we idolize, not being the usual suspects, not being people that everybody knows, not, you know, even picking Hoda Kotb, you know, as a replacement for Matt Lauer instead of some, I mean, literally, I had a lot of people ask me, who is she? How do you say her name? There were a lot of people who don't watch the Today Show, who don't know who she is. And so this strategy of sort of not going to the easy wins in terms of big names is something that is going to continue to be really exciting for people. And part of that is just because there's this complete lack of faith in institutions and mistrust of, you know, and we see this, like, you know, Harvey Weinstein was the biggest guy in Hollywood, and now he's fallen, and all these people have fallen. So it's really about moving away from the way we celebrated, or the way we chose the people we celebrated.
Do you think all of that is a reaction to the Trump election, or in line with it? How do you think it relates, if you think it relates?
Well, I will say, given the perspective of the past 10 years of studying culture, that it was we see its roots in the economic collapse. That, you know, that was the first sign that things were not what they seemed, that there was a bubble, that we had been sold a bill of goods in terms of what was happening in the economy and our real estate prices and our Wall Street portfolios that wasn't really there. And, you know, there's also, you have an entire generation of millennials who graduated from college expecting to have these amazing high-priced jobs that disappeared because of the economic collapse, and yet they had been raised to expect them because they did all the things they were supposed to do growing up and going to school, the right schools, and going to test prep and having their lacrosse and ballet and their community service, right? So this became this questioning of the system that happened with the economic collapse that has only just continued to kind of metastasize. You know, I read a headline in the paper today that said chaos is normal now. And, you know, in 2010, when we started really doing our reports at Truthco on culture, we called what this era chaos culture. So these kinds of ideas are not new. The Trump election is a symptom of that larger cultural theme of the distrust of institutions that really had its roots 10 years ago.
But
you're right. All those things are connected. And that's the great thing about culture is that, you know, what we really try to do is illuminate those connections that are sometimes hidden.
I mean, yeah, that is a whole separate podcast, maybe for someone else to do, but it's interesting because it's not my forte, but it's interesting to think about, yeah, the economic collapse, also what that, you know, how that separated classes out, what you're talking about, the 1%, the rise of the Tea
economic
Party.
Economic inequality, racial inequality, gender inequality, all these, all of, you know, even, you know, the sexual harassment conversation, the climate that we were in that enabled women to feel that they could speak out. And it's not solely because of this, but remember what happened a few years ago, which was monumental in this culture, was the passage of gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you have this breaking down of these traditional barriers to inequality that all become like dominoes. And so, you know, these things are all related, and that's why it's really important, I think, for people to have, you know, they don't have to study culture the way we do, although I'm a total nerd and I love to do it, but I think appreciate that, you know, unlike someone who once said to me, a good show is a good show is a good show, you could put it on, you could put it, say, elsewhere on today and it would rate. And I, you know, I would push back and I would say, you know, every show that is successful in its moment has cultural reasons why it's successful. And so just appreciate, and yes, you have to have, of course, you have a good plot and good direction and good actors and all that. But those are constants, right? That's like table stakes to have a good show. Then you have to have, a show that actually speaks to the time.
It's interesting in light of Trump's election and, you know, the fact that he's got allegations of this sort against him, but they seem to bounce off him. But then that you're having all these, you know, Weinstein has essentially lost everything. I mean, for these other men, or Matt Lauer, you know, where they're absolutely removed from the situation. So I mean, it's kind of a ping pong to me. Like, on one hand, you've got, and the same thing with gay marriage, which I feel like in a way the election was a reaction against that progress.
Yeah.
But then on this other, you know, on this other side, you still have this progress going, or you have people reacting against the system. And then, I don't know, I just think it's like we've got these two forces sort of working either against each other or in reaction to each other.
Well, one of my trends, we're going to talk about that a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah,
so
I know.
Let's keep going, because I think it's more than two, but we'll keep going. And then
okay.
We'll
the other thing I was going to just throw out there that isn't really that relevant, but I personally love Hoda Kotb and think she's an incredible choice. And I do think that even you saw it when Savannah was making the announcement about Matt Lauer, like the kind of chemistry they have. And I've interviewed Hoda and she's just a very empathetic person. So I just think that was a big win for today.
It's great. And I think, again, the fact that not everybody knows who she is just, it's really good for her because they're not going to come with a ton of expectations. You know,
yeah.
I think it's interesting too. And this is just sort of back to the prior note about the unsung heroes. You have right now a climate where it's very possible that no-name actors can become really big stars. So whoever really heard about Claire Foy before The Crown, right? But she was not a household name, right?
No.
And part of, I believe, from a cultural perspective, what enables that to happen is because we don't know about who she's dating or where she went to dinner last night. And we, you know, these are not widely tracked celebrities before they become stars, right? And so when you cast somebody in a role that, you know, cast someone who's not as well known to the American public, let's say in the case of the States, that person instantly becomes more believable than casting, you know, Tom Cruise, who you know everything about. And so there's an opportunity both from an economic standpoint to discover talent that is more affordable, but also they're more moldable into the characters.
And it's just refreshing, frankly.
Yeah. And so, you know, with Hoda, you know, other than her fans, nobody really has any expectations. And so it's not like pulling in somebody that everybody knows and has a big name and you know and you have an expectation of what that person is going to be, like Megyn Kelly, right? Megyn Kelly's had a lot of trouble because people have expectations of what she's going to be. And so they're always measuring her against that.
I feel like it's changing for Megan because she's kind of leaning into what she's known for.
Well, exactly. But in the beginning, they leaned away from it, right? And so that was the challenge because she came in, she was known for something, people tuned in. That's a whole other podcast. Too,
I know. But, like, you know,
but one of the reasons, right? But one of the reasons, you know, that it was challenging for her is because she was in a completely different alien format with an alien audience, doing content that was very different than what she was known for. So again, I think that, you know, that's the challenge these days is that when you have a name, they come with so much baggage and some of it's good and some of it's not so good. And it's really about how you play that.
Yeah. All right. Second trend.
Second trend is related to the unsung heroes. And we really call it, you know, overlooked or alternative perspectives, which is not only are there different people that we haven't heard of or that we haven't elevated, but there are entire points of view that have been overlooked in conversations. So a great example of this is the recent emergence in the sexual harassment conversation of blue-collar workers, right? All the conversations in the end of the year last year about sexual harassment were largely about Hollywood, about executives and tech companies. It was very white collar, very white. And not to say there wasn't a lot of disgruntlement among people of color that was happening, but it wasn't really kind of recognized as a movement until much more recently. And that, you know, harassment is something that happens probably to an even greater extent the lower the income. And so what was interesting about the recent announcement by the group of people in Hollywood and the legal defense fund set up by Time's Up, that it was intentionally not just for Hollywood, that it was intentionally aimed at farm workers and lower income wage workers and creating equality for all. And it's interesting because I've always personally defined feminism as equality from a woman's point of view, but it's not just about equality for women. It's about every person being equal because you can't, it's sort of counterintuitive to say, well, it's just equality for some people, right? And so, So, you know, when feminists, and you know, again, not everyone's going to agree with me, but from my point of view, a feminist just is looking for, you know, the playing field to be equal for everybody, and is just attacking sort of how do we get it for women at this, you know, that's the focus for women. Just as, you know, it's not about, as some people are afraid, that the women's movement is about belittling or marginalizing men. It's not at all about that. It's just about recognizing that men have had it better, right? And just kind of equalizing that opportunity. So these kinds of overlooked perspectives, just to give you some more examples, you know, people are, as you know, flocking to podcasts. So that will increase this year because you have the opportunity. It's a very cheap, very accessible, very digestible medium. I don't even listen to the radio anymore. I just listen to podcasts all the time in the car. But you can find voices from all over, and it's a very democratic medium, right? Because you can find all kinds of content.
What I was thinking is that it's interesting. Well, two things. First of all, obviously, I pay too much attention to Trump administration because when you talk about overlooked perspectives, one thing I think about is I think that was part of the appeal of that was that people who felt overlooked did not feel overlooked by him. So he that felt empowering to them for whatever reasons correct or incorrect.
Yeah.
Well, then correct I also,
from their perspective. And right. I think that's the thing, right, is that everyone's perspective is right from their perspective.
Right, exactly.
And, go ahead.
The other thing I was just going to say is that I think I've mentioned this on this podcast before, but I had been interviewing Paul Telegdy. He's the head of Unscripted at NBC. And he was saying how we were talking about Will and Grace, actually. But what he was saying is that what you don't really have in pop culture anymore is that one show or all those shows that people all watch. So you have sort of a similar view on things because people can go to podcasts or they can go to Alex Jones or they can go to all these different places to get news and information. You don't really have a collected opinion on anything. Mm-hmm. So, and people also seek out what they, you know, seek out what they agree with. So it ends up making this very fractured culture, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. just sort of contributes to all of this. But when you talk about overlooked perspectives, how do you think that applies then to entertainment? Like if you were going to tell a brand, how does you're going to talk to them about overlooked perspectives? How would you tell the brand this applies to what you're doing?
Well, it's interesting because we have been working with a lot of programmers recently on, about looking at second, third, fourth seasons of dramas, right? And one of the things we say is look at the secondary characters, look at the tertiary characters. Maybe for the next season, you want to make them the lead, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the same lead from season to season. And that's more interesting because you've heard, I'm sure, this whole concept of world building, right? Mm-hmm. That really
yes.
popularized by Game of Thrones and yes. other kinds of fantasy shows. But, you know, world building is just about saying the show exists in an environment and let's see other perspectives of that environment, right? Let's see some other zip codes. Let's see some other economics stratas. Let's see some other workplaces. Let's see, you know, it can be kind of endless. And I think for a brand, it's something Bravo has actually continued to do since we relaunched it in 2004, is that they're just constantly mining the same world, but looking at younger people in that world, looking at different towns in that world, looking at different occupations in that world. But they're constantly mining the same world. And that's been a large part of their brand success. And I think that when you even look at shows that have very different kinds of shows, networks that have very different kinds of shows, there's always a connective tissue that we can draw culturally or from a psychographic standpoint, because that's sort of the sensibility of the network anyway, right? Yeah. And so this idea, it's very similar to what Marvel does with their character universes. You've got all these different superheroes that ostensibly come from different planets and different places, have different origin stories, and what they've been working on for the past several years, and they're finally culminating in is tying all the worlds together. Right. Mm-hmm. And saying this is how now every one of our characters is interacting in one way or another with another one of our characters. And I think that's the way brands should look at their shows now. Networks should look at their shows is like we have a universe. These people all live together. What is it that they have in common? What are the rules of our universe? And we're actually working with a network that I can't name, but really helping them kind of have that worldview of all their programming and dealing with all their marketing and promotion in that way.
Again, people who've listened to this know that I am an obsessed Game of Thrones fan. And also just in general, I like things that involve world building. So mm-hmm. yeah, that rings really true to me. And I think that Marvel, what they're doing, I think Star Wars, what they're doing, mm-hmm. I mean, to some extent it becomes, especially with Marvel, at least right now, it feels like a little bit like overkill. But the flip side of it is that it's cool to have these worlds that you can get really immersed in and see all these different parts of.
Exactly. And it's not even like spinoff culture, right? It's just taking the idea to a really much more creative, much more imaginative place where, you know, most shows have protagonists and antagonists. And, you know, it's flopping the perspective. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like you may have been following the hero and now you're going to follow the villain. Or, you know, there's even a greater interest now literally in international, global content. When we talk about world building, what about our own world? Right.
Mm-hmm.
The show Dark, which I'm completely obsessed with, which is, I believe, a Swedish show. Thank you. I was having a mind brain freeze. But, you know, looking at that are shows like Fauda and shows with formats from other countries. There's a lot more, I think, you know, the paradigm shift that's happened in global tastes is that it doesn't need to be Americanized anymore for people to like it. And it actually feels fresher when it's not, sort of tightly wedded to, you know, a predictable format or a predictable rhythm. And of course, there's always viewers that are going to really want that closed-end procedural, and those do very well on broadcast, as we all know. But there is an appetite for showing us something new.
I think that topic actually leads us into your third trend.
You are right, and that is about the world becoming increasingly surreal. And this idea is about our everyday existence is so crazy right now with everything that's going on politically, socially, environmentally. In New York, they're freezing their butts off today. Yes. Everything has ratcheted up to the next level, to the point where entertainment still needs to be an escape. But in order to do that, it's really got to go to one extreme or the other. And one of those extremes is just taking things even crazier and bananas. And that is everything from virtual reality and AR and MR and all those kinds of technical, gadgetry, right, and gimmickry, to really what, you know, civic stock and trade is, which is immersive experiential storytelling mm-hmm. through activations. And people really want to experience how crazy these worlds are in a, you know, IRL, in real life world. Even, you know, going so far as, you know, creating ways to translate the URL effects of Snapchat filters and, you know, effects and things like that into their own real life experiences. And that's, you have, you know, a lot more Comic-Con, cosplay and, you know, a desire to elevate the everyday beyond sort of its own insanity and take things to the next level. So I think one of the things that we see is that there's a lot of interest in animation these days, in mixing animation with live action and shows, in being trippier, taking concepts that are much, you know, that 2 years ago would have been seemingly crazy or far out there, and treating them as if they're normal. And we're working on a couple of shows right now where, you know, that kind of appeal feels really, really relevant because it's still escapist, but it deals with sort of where people's heads are today. So, you know, it used to be that being surreal or being trippy was sort of the province of Adult Swim or a cartoon or a sci-fi, but mm-hmm. now we're seeing those kinds of elements being incorporated into, you know, straight-ahead series with bottle episodes or with weird flashbacks or, you know, this opportunity to insert this element of surreality into the everyday is becoming more and more acceptable.
I'm both super excited for that and extremely terrified by it. Yeah. So again, I'm a nerd like this, so I love Game of Thrones and I love Harry Potter. And for in June, Promax's party was at Harry Potter at Universal Studios. Mm-hmm. So if you've been there, they have that ride where you go through Hogwarts. And it did make me a little nauseous. It was really, really fun. But I was like, what if this is what movies become like? Just experience it like this. And then I thought, would you ever want to leave? I mean, you could really just, and AR is somewhat like that too, and it's only going to get more so, where you are really deeply immersed in it. And I mean, I could also see people, this is going to sound funny, but I mean it sort of seriously, but I mean, I could see people having heart attacks. I mean, it's pretty, I think your brain processes it as if it's really happening. So it's a
That's another podcast.
Yeah, it's an super exciting prospect, but it's like, I think that whole concept could really, I mean, change the world radically. And we've only just beginning to see it.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, it's really kind of the theme parkization of entertainment, you know, and even something in a very kind of, in a much lower fi version of that, but a very, very impactful ways, you know, just the way the Mr. Robot audience interacts with that show, and the way the marketing team does a fantastic
that
job
of blurring.
Yeah, they blur the lines between fantasy and reality to the point where people are living, you know, going to the store and living, you know, at South By and or Comic Con and living, you know, living the show, which is the audience's dream. That's the fans' dream, is to really be part of the show. And there's a lot of ways that that's happening in a production standpoint, but to actually give your audience and those fans the ability to live that dream is becoming more and more common.
I mean, well, Harry Potter is a good example. If anybody goes there, that it's, you go to Hogsmeade and it looks very much like what you think it looks like. So that feels incredibly immersive. But think about, you know, if you love Westworld, it would be, it would not, you know, HBO could build a HBO could run that business and you could go to Westworld and have that kind of experience. So it doesn't even seem like that big of a stretch, but.
Right. I mean, one thing that I'm really interested in at Civic, and, you know, the part of the reason that we're there is because we can take these insights and help them fuel really culturally impactful activations, which they were doing anyway, but now we can really study it and put some real science behind it. But, you know, you have this opportunity to really just take things to the next level. It's super exciting. And, you know, you could even envision a network having, you know, essentially a theme park, right? You could have their own or their own Comic-Con version. Yeah, or you could have a network, you know, festival where you're able to experience and interact with your favorite shows in ways that people are really into doing right now. And again, experiences being, you know, as we've all heard, experiences being more valued than things right now, especially by millennials and younger, that really immersive quality of, it's interesting, the more digital the world becomes, the more people crave and value face-to-face interactions. And so that's an opportunity, I think, especially for 2018, and part of why I joined Civic is because I felt that opportunity to interact with the brand live and hands-on, especially one that was mission-driven or was sensitive to what was going on in the world, is going to become more, increasingly more important.
Okay, I could talk about that for 4 hours, but let's go on to friend four.
Okay, number four, and I was going to say, this number four is probably one of my favorites for the year, and that I would say I would ask your listeners to pay the most attention to, which is we've all heard a lot about fandom over the past couple of years, and we know that it is really sort of a more psychographic view of audiences than in the prior era, which was more demographically focused. But what we see happening now is this incredible fragmentation of fandom. And I mentioned that I was going to talk about this earlier when you were talking about the divide, sort of seeming like there's two sides to every group of, you know, to every topic or every show or whatever. But there's, what we're seeing is increasingly there's many, many, many more. And again, you've got a democracy when it comes to content. Anybody can access this. They're all going to look at it, as you mentioned, through their own lens. And what we're finding is in every conversation, whether it's about a show like Game of Thrones, where you may have people who are diehard book fans whose, you know, desire is to really track every point of continuity with the book and, you know, really faithfulness to the characters and the plot, to people who are diehard, who would also consider themselves diehard Game of Thrones fans, who are, you know, obsessed with the continuity of the show from season to season and the behind the scenes and, you know, things that are really, really pertaining in a very deep and insightful way to the actual television show. They're, you know, they could have a contest on who's the bigger Game of Thrones fans, and they'd both be right. So, and by the way, there's many, many, many different factions in between. And you have this in the feminism conversation. You have this in the Republican Party. You have this in the Democratic Party. So every group of what we call fans, and, you know, which are essentially, you know, self-assembled groups who have an affinity for something, right, you have this incredible fragmentation. And, you know, you see this also in what were formerly called minority groups, right? If you look at people of color like the Black audience, it's not a monolithic audience. You've got a lot of different tastes and types. And so it's this recognition that, you know, even for a show, a fan is not monolithic. And it is really about understanding that you have to feed, for a show like Game of Thrones or Mr. Robot or whatever, you have to really be able to feed the different interests and understand that they're all sort of vying for supremacy. And there's opportunities, I think, in really recognizing that. And I haven't seen anyone yet really play to those factions. So that, I think, that's increasing, and they're becoming louder. I think there's the opportunity, for good or for bad, for sort of conflict and divisiveness. But I think there's also an opportunity to just really explore the great diversity within any one fan base.
I mean, I think that there are networks leaning into the fandom, but there's probably always more they could do. Because, for example, not to harp on Game of Thrones, but that's one I'm very familiar with. So what's amazing about Game of Thrones is that they've got this huge worldwide audience. So right off the bat, that's a win. But then you have, I mean, I don't know how many Game of Thrones podcasts there are. There's tons. Mm-hmm. There's Reddit. There's all these different places that people can go and engage about that in all different ways. And I mean, right. We talked about Mr. Robot. I think that's a similar fandom, mm-hmm. Not as large. But I do think that from a marketing perspective, I mean, that's really the brass ring, right? Like, you want to have a show or a brand or whatever where people are that obsessed and that engaged that they're willing to spend their free time and they're willing to go to these different places totally off network to engage with that content. I think that's mm-hmm. and that's marketing that you don't even have to touch. Just does it for you.
Well, and I think, you know, the interesting thing to me from a cultural perspective about this vying for supremacy among the different fragments and factions and a fan base is that creates amazing conversation and amazing buzz, mm-hmm. right? And so I think the question is, how do you, as a brand, how do you harness that fragmentation and not make it completely destructive, right? Because we've seen how that can happen when people get, you know, in the tech world with Gamergate, when people get really, mm-hmm. really, violent and ugly, that's not what you want to have happen. But I do think there is this opportunity to recognize that any show with a broad fan base is going to have different segments and that there's a way to kind of call them out, give them all equal love. Right. But sort of acknowledge that not everybody who is a fan of a show or a brand is going to see things the same way. Just like, you know, in a sports team, not everyone's going to see, you know, everyone's going to have their favorite players. They're going to have differences of opinions. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about fandom is that it implies you have something to lose. There's an emotional stake and that you're not always going to be happy. You know, the Star Wars fans are not all, look at the debate about, another great example, Star Wars, you know, the Last Jedi, huge debate about the merits of that movie. Now, that doesn't hurt the movie because the movie did really well, is continuing doing really well, but just acknowledging that not everyone who has, again, deep emotional stakes in this content is going to agree.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but you think that it is possible for brands to come in and channel that? Or do you think those conversations just happen organically? I mean, how as a brand would you come in and sort of manage that if things went off the rails?
Well, if it was off the rails, I think part of it is understanding that everyone feels that they're equally, you know, again, it's that alternative perspective and understanding from every group's point of view, they feel that they have a right to claim the throne, right? It becomes its own Game of Thrones, right? And I think that the challenge for a brand, I don't have the magic solution, so I'm sorry that I can't tell you the answer to that. But I think part of it is, it's just like, and again, this mirrors the larger cultural debate, which is we are a very fragmented society. People like to say it's divided, but I think it's really fragmented.
Yeah.
And so, and I'm sure most people would agree. And so I think that the solution to fragmentation is not to shut other people out, right? It's to have conversations and try to understand. And actually, if I can segue to the last trend, number five, which is really about we're moving towards a culture that is beginning to really understand we have so many differences, but what unites us are human values. What unites us is really things that aren't partisan or politicized. So a show like This Is Us, which, you know, there's all kinds of different social issues that they deal with, which are amazing, but they're not presented in a divisive or partisan manner, right? You're talking about
right.
race, you're looking at intergenerational conflict, you're looking at economic inequality, you're looking at a lot of, you're looking at body types, many, many different conversations that are incredibly culturally relevant right now, but they're presented in a way that unifies people. So I think there are examples. You know, even looking at shows like The Good Doctor, you know, that deal with autism, or looking at Will and Grace and looking at LGBT issues with a fresh lens. You know, even Keeping Up with the Kardashians has dealt with, you know, Kim's robbery and, you know, dealing with, of course, Caitlyn, and dealing with a lot of social issues, but not doing them in a divisive way. And I think part of that is by them presenting not the, and this, when I say them, I mean all these shows, it's not about the shows saying this is the perspective on race or the perspective on inequality, but saying this is a perspective. And I think the more of those kinds of conversations we can have on a human level, we can understand not only what makes us different, but importantly, what makes us the same.
I think also bringing up This Is Us in the context of that, of what you just said, it's just a really good point, because it's a kind of, it shows that there's a need for that. People want to feel emotionally connected. People want to feel in general. There's no judgment around that show, really.
Right.
It's not super, there's issues, but you're right, it's not super issue driven, and you can kind of just enjoy it and feel and cry or whatever. And,
right.
And obviously people are attracted to that. And there's not very much like it on television right now.
I
feel like it's a throwback. There used to be stuff like that, but not so much anymore. So it's interesting that there's been kind of a longing for it that show seems to have fulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the closest thing I'm really going to date myself, but you know, I remember 30-something made me feel that way. This sense that, you know, there was something that really brought us all together at the end of the day. And I think, you know, we are the family of man. So as much as we may have different goals and opinions and outlooks, there are things that really bring us together. And I think those kinds of shows, even a show like The Good Place, you know, is doing that. And so I think there is increasingly a desire, and we heard this after the election, so this is not new, but I think in television and media in general is starting to really respond to what I would call almost, you know, a little bit more sentimental view of the world, sentimental not in a sappy way, but one that just sort of recognizes that, you know, in spite of all our differences, we're all human, and those emotions and those values are equally important.
I think that's a perfect spot to wrap this up on. I'm laughing, though, because I was really like, I hope we can fill enough time. I could really talk about, like, most of these topics first. Like, we could
I'm
do
a nerd.
A 10-hour podcast, which
do.
No one wants to hear.
I could do. We'll just talk to each other.
All right. Well, I'll have you back on because I have many other things I want to talk about.
Great. So, I would love that.
All right. So, Linda, thank you so much. It was completely fascinating, and I will talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Paige. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Paige Alpiniak is editorial director of Promax BDA. LaFern Cusack is executive producer of the Daily Brief podcast and senior producer at Promax BDA. Video helper provides the music. Digital producer Kate LaCaire-Marion and social media coordinator Kristen Craik contribute to Daily Brief. Follow Paige on Twitter at Paige A. Follow LaFern at LaFern Cusack and follow Promax BDA at Promax BDA. You can reach out to us at dailybrief@promaxbda.org. And you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Podomatic, and now on Spotify. Thanks for listening.